The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When a Virginia outdoorsman fails to return from a day of hunting in the woods behind his home, authorities suspect an accident and hope to rescue him quickly. When no trace of him can be found, the investigation that follows explores the possibility of foul play in the Appalachian Mountains in this episode of Last Seen Alive. Thanks for listening to Last Seen Alive. I'm your host, Leah, crime analyst by day and true crime storyteller by night.
And as always, I'm your co-host, Scott.
Before we begin this episode, I want to give a special thanks to Alicia, a friend of mine who is a native of Southern Virginia who told me about this case. If not for her, we never would have done this episode. And for the record, she's also the one who put the Short family case B in my bonnet. So if you enjoyed that episode, and if you enjoy this one, you have her to thank. Eric Smith was last seen alive on November 8, 2013. 41 years old at the time, Eric lived in rural Tazewell County, Virginia, a place located in the southern corner of the state in the Appalachian Mountains. It's a place known for outdoor pursuits. For example, its roads are so scenic that they're considered some of the best for motorcycle riding in all of Appalachia. Besides its beauty, the area is also well known for its industry. When you think of coal fields, chances are you think of states like West Virginia or Kentucky. But Tazewell County, Virginia, which isn't far from the West Virginia state line, has a long history of coal mining too, so much so that one of its enormous coal mines has been turned into a museum.
Is that the Big Ride?
I don't know. I know you go into the mines, so I'm not really sure, but gosh, how could I forget about Pennsylvania and Scranton City when it comes to discussing coal mining? What a fool I am.
Can't leave out the Electric City.
Anyway, in fact, coal mining was exactly how Eric made a living. He worked for a company called Consol Energy, but he wasn't just any miner. He was a general foreman at the Buchanan Coal Mine No. 1. Which produces more than 5 million tons of coal per year. There, he supervised hundreds of employees and was responsible for ensuring that the mine operated in accordance with both state and federal law. Obviously, this position entailed a lot of responsibility. Eric was on call 24/7 and was considered a reliable and responsible employee. At 41, he was actually pretty young to hold such a senior position. And he hadn't accomplished so much so quickly by being a flake. His co-workers described him as safety conscious and production oriented, someone you could count on not just to be there, but to do the job right.
So you mentioned motorcycle riding and Tazewell. That's like the back of the dragon goes through there, right?
Exactly. That's the section of road that's considered some of the best motorcycle riding in the Appalachians. It's pretty famous.
And I just have to wonder, given your off-air obsession with outlaw MCs, are there any outlaw MC conspiracies that we get to dive down?
Conspiracies, no. According to an article by journalist Greg Jordan for the Bluefield Daily Telegraph, Eric was usually the first one at work in the morning, and it was common for his co-workers to arrive to find him already studying mining law as he planned their work for the day. Besides being dedicated to his job, he was also dedicated to his family. He was married, had children, and his parents lived in the area as well. Eric's dedication to his family and work are exactly what made what happened in the fall of 2013 so strange.
We're coming right up on a decade.
Yeah. At the time of this recording, it's been just about 9 years. It will be 9 years this fall. So very swiftly coming up on a decade, unfortunately. The change to Eric's normal routine began not on the day of his disappearance, but rather in late October when he went on a week-long business trip to Atlanta, Georgia. According to the Charlie Project, Eric was scheduled to resume his regular duties immediately upon return, reporting to work in the mine the morning after he got home from Atlanta. However, that's not what happened. Instead, Eric seemingly caught some sort of virus or other illness while out of town. Which wouldn't be unusual. It's common to catch a bug while traveling, especially during fall when cold and flu season sets in. Also, I don't know whether Eric drove or flew to Atlanta, but if he flew, the Atlanta airport is literally the busiest airport in the entire world. When you go there, you're rubbing shoulders with travelers from all over the country and the planet, so there's certainly the potential to pick up a few germs along the way. Eric was reportedly sick with flu or even pneumonia-like symptoms and wasn't well enough to return to the mine the next day as he'd been scheduled to do. So, his wife called in sick on his behalf, letting his employer know that he wouldn't be coming in. And I've got a quick aside here regarding Eric's wife. While researching this case, I noticed that none of the news articles or media surrounding it refer to her or either of Eric's children by name, nor have any of those media sources published any photos that included her or the children. This is unusual, so I assume it was an intentional choice in that she prefers for her name and image, along with her children's, not to be included in news stories about her husband's disappearance.
Well within her rights.
Yeah, therefore, out of respect for what I suspect may be her wishes, I'm not going to call her by name either. It would feel awkward to keep calling her Eric's wife, though, since she's her own person, so I'm just going to call her Jane, which is neither her real name nor anything close to it. And don't worry, knowing or not knowing her real first name won't impact your understanding of the story at all.
There's no suspicion around Jane, then?
In my opinion, no. I don't suspect her. If I did, I would use her name. I wouldn't try to actively shield someone from suspicion or publicity if I thought they were guilty. Now, this is just my opinion, but in my opinion, I don't think that she was involved. Most likely not. So, Eric ended up being out sick for 5 days, and then when he was feeling well enough to leave the house again, he emailed his employer and told them that he'd be taking another day off to go hunting.
So, going from too sick to call him for yourself to going hunting?
Yeah, it may seem a little odd at first, considering that Eric had been away on business for a week and then sick for nearly another week. Considering what a responsible and conscientious worker he was known to be, one might think he'd want to get back to work already. But let me tell you, it might not be so unusual as a hunter. There's another side to the coin.
Is it the very restrictive rifle season?
It's not rifle season. It's frankly even better. Eric was really into hunting, and his back-to-back business trip and illness had caused him to miss out on nearly 2 weeks of the hunting season. And I have little doubt that this pained him. For anyone not familiar with hunting laws in the U.S., hunting is a strictly regulated seasonal activity. And the longer the season goes on, the more wary and avoidant of humans deer become due to something called hunting pressure. So hunting early in the season is generally easier than hunting later. And the best hunting time by far is during the rut, a time period when bucks throw caution to the wind to become brazen in their pursuit of does to mate with. This is the best time to harvest a mature buck, which is what most deer hunters are after. A deer's life is difficult, and in the wild, deer don't live to maturity without being cautious. So typically, the only time that mature bucks are careless is during the rut. Other than that, good luck getting them in your crosshairs because you're going to need it.
I mean, I had some luck.
Yes, it's not impossible, but it's more difficult. If Eric missed the rut, he'd be left with just the late season to hunt, which is generally the toughest hunting. Speaking of the rut, it's triggered by changes in the amount of daylight present in a day. In southwestern Virginia, where Eric lived and hunted, peak rut usually occurs in the first or second week in November. Or in other words, exactly when Eric went out for this spontaneous day of hunting. Remember, this was November 8th.
That really is like the prime time to go hunting. And as I mentioned earlier, while I was able to get a buck outside of the rut, one of us got the biggest deer that we had had all season. And that was not me. And that came on the very last day of the season.
Yes, that was, of course, me. And it was the biggest deer we got all year. And it wasn't even a buck. It was the biggest doe of all time. And I'm very proud of this, which is why I'm talking about it now.
But the other thing to remember that I alluded to earlier was Virginia has very restrictive hunting season.
So yes.
Only 2 weeks for rifles. So if you're...
Yeah, out of the whole year, 2 weeks for rifle season, that's it. There are restrictions on what kind of deer you can harvest on any given day. Antlered, antlerless.
So if you're caught out on one of those days and you could see biggest buck in the world and you might not be able to take it.
Yeah.
And that is very restrictive to the counties even. Mm-hmm. So every county's different.
Virginia hunting laws are strict and they're highly differentiated among different counties and areas of the state, such as east and west of the Blue Ridge. Very restricted. It's not like you can go out and just shoot anything. So for Virginia hunters, they really have to time it to be out there at the best time to get what they want to get with the weapon that they want to get.
And then you get into public versus private land.
Yes. A whole nother can of worms. He was hunting on private land, which is the best place to hunt because there's the least amount of restrictions. But so as someone who also hunts deer, I have to contend that Eric's decision to go off into the woods instead of the mines was perhaps not as strange as it might seem at first glance. This is one of few prime hunting days, and hunting was his big thing. So it's easy for me to imagine that Eric might have thought, hey, he'd already been out for nearly 2 weeks. What was one more day? Especially since once he returned, he might be too entrenched in making up for lost time to get out and hunt. Now, what I do find potentially strange is that Eric emailed his work to inform them of his intent to take another day off rather than calling. Remember, Jane had called in on his behalf 5 days beforehand to let him know that he was sick. And during this illness, Eric hadn't called in to check on how work was going. So, to the best of my knowledge, no one at his work had heard his voice since he'd returned home from his business trip. Obviously, from an investigative standpoint, this is something that raises questions. Why were all of Eric's communications with his employer in the near week leading up to his disappearance conducted either via email or via Jane calling in for him? Had his illness led to the temporary loss or significant diminishment of his voice? I haven't read anything that states this was the case. It's just a thought. Or had he perhaps sent that email instead of calling because calling in instead might have led to him being pressured to return to work instead of taking another day off for hunting? I mean, no one can try to stop you from taking the day off if you fire off an email and then disappear into the woods where there's no hope of cell phone reception, right?
I mean, the only thing I'm really thinking about right now is how can we be sure that Eric was even alive at that point?
Well, no, we can't. Not to the best of my knowledge. And that's a big question, obviously. And then I ask myself, was communicating via email like this a normal thing for Eric? Unfortunately, I don't know. And then, of course, as you just alluded to, there's the darker possibility. Because you see, Eric never returned from that hunting trip and no trace of him has been found since. So this has led some to wonder, is it possible that Eric wasn't really homesick in the 5 days preceding that alleged hunting trip? Could he already have been missing, and could the illness and a hunting trip have been a cover story?
I mean, it's something that definitely needs to be explored or at least contemplated, and I'm sure law enforcement has.
Yeah, I would think so. I certainly hope so. So this theory, which, by the way, has not been publicly proposed or promoted by police, entails two separate possibilities, as best I can figure. And those are, one, Eric went missing or perhaps even failed to return home from his business trip, and Jane was doing her best to cover for him so that he wouldn't get in trouble at work or potentially even lose his job. Eventually, when he failed to return for an extended period of time, this well-meaning ruse would have become unsustainable. Or, two, Eric went missing as a result of foul play, and Jane was either involved in some way or at least had knowledge of it.
The only thing I don't buy about the first one is how dependable it was. If he was somebody that would go off for a week or spend an extra week in Atlanta, and that was like a plan between Jane and him, and that wasn't uncommon, I could see that happening. But if he's so dependable, I still have questions.
Yeah, I strongly suspect that he arrived home from his business trip as scheduled. But I want to clarify by saying that I don't personally know of any motive Jane might have had to want him gone. And other than the fact that no one actually heard from Eric during those 5 days of alleged illness, I don't know of anything that cast potential suspicion her way. I only know that statistics dictate that when foul play is known or suspected, investigators must explore the possibility of spousal involvement. I'll conclude that theory here, though, because like I said, there's really not anything else to discuss as far as publicly available knowledge goes. If Eric went missing sooner than November 8th and Jane was merely doing her best to preserve his reputation for reliability at work, well, it's really unfortunate that he never returned. I suspect that if that was the case, she probably thought that he'd be back in a day or two and everything would be fine. No one would be any the wiser. Unfortunately, it's been 9 years since Eric disappeared at the time of this recording, and there are still no answers despite extensive search efforts. Now, the area where Eric set out to hunt that day was on property he owned. In fact, it was property he lived on. His house sat on 40 wooded acres or 16 hectares of land.
Oh, that's amazing.
Right? All he had to do was walk out the door and into the woods, so it's not like he drove anywhere in a vehicle.
I imagine there was a good fishing spot there, too.
Well, actually, I looked at the aerial map and I did not see any bodies of water. So maybe there was a stream I couldn't see, but there's definitely not a lake or a pond. But the point is, he was living our dream, walking out the door and hunting. What a dream.
Our dream includes a stream full of fish.
It does. But while Eric set out to hunt, Jane set out on a trip of her own to a nearby town where her mother lived. There, she helped her mom set up and decorate a Christmas tree. Now, I mentioned earlier that Eric and Jane had children. They had two daughters, and for the record, I know that Jane took one of their daughters with her on the trip. As for the other daughter, she was an adult at the time of Eric's disappearance, so it's possible that she didn't live at home anymore, or that even if she did, she simply wasn't home at the time. I'm not sure. None of the sources I've read mention anything about the other daughter being home alone at the house that day, so it's possible that while Eric was hunting, the house was empty. I don't know that for sure, though, and I wish I did because I think it would lend a little clarity to the theories we're about to discuss. More on those next.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And now, back to Eric's story. What I do know is that when Jane and their younger daughter returned home that evening, Eric was nowhere to be found. His cell phone and cigarettes were in the house, and they knew that if he'd gone anywhere other than hunting, he would have taken those items along. Plus, they found his wallet left in his truck. So it seemed as if Eric had simply never returned from hunting, which was, of course, alarming considering that it was already dark. I can only imagine how badly I'd be panicking if I were in Jane's shoes, because there's so much that can potentially go wrong while hunting.
I will just stop and interject. The presence of the wallet and cell phone does give more credence to the fact that he did come back from Atlanta on his business trip.
Yeah, to the best of my understanding, it's not totally clear and reported in the sources I've read, but from the somewhat less reliable sources I've looked into, it definitely does seem as if he returned from his Atlanta business trip. Plus, there's the fact that obviously his work could have looked into and verified that very easily, and if he hadn't returned, the investigation would have taken a whole different direction. So I'm confident that he did, in fact, return from Atlanta. I just don't know what happened to him after he returned. So, after finding no sign that Eric had ever emerged from the woods, Jane went to Eric's mom, Dreema, who lived nearby. Drima was instantly alarmed when her daughter-in-law told her what was going on. And so Jane called 911 and explained the circumstances to the dispatcher. Realizing the danger Eric might be in if he were injured and stranded out in the cold woods, authorities launched a search. They began by combing over 40 acres of land Eric owned, which was where he'd told Jane he'd planned to hunt. When they didn't find him there, they massively expanded their search parameters, ultimately searching approximately 800 acres, many of which were wooded, over the course of a week.
So they didn't just throw together a sloppy investigation of the area?
No, not at all. They took it really seriously from the beginning. Law enforcement participated in the search, not just local law enforcement, but state law enforcement. And also, you had a lot of locals who wanted to participate. People that Eric worked with in the mines, just people in general from the community. This is a rural, small town kind of place. So when he went missing, people were concerned and they wanted to help. Now, obviously, it takes more than just boots on the ground to thoroughly search 800 acres, especially since a lot of the terrain they were searching was rough. There's a lot of hills, a lot of mountains, a lot of underbrush. That's just how it is in that area. In addition to law enforcement and civilian foot searchers, over the course of a week, authorities also utilized multiple search canines and a helicopter equipped with FLIR thermal image cameras.
Love me some FLIR.
You would say that. Despite these search efforts, searchers weren't able to locate any trace of Eric. Search canines tracking his scent were able to pick up a few scent trails at the house, naturally, but they didn't go far, and there was no telling how old the trails may have been. Authorities expected the dogs to follow Eric's scent trail through the woods, but they didn't.
Like, he never went in them, didn't? Or just they lost the trail, didn't?
Who's to say? That's one of the big questions. Not only was there no sign of Eric, but there was no sign of his clothing or of the .50 caliber muzzle-loading hunting rifle he'd taken along on his hunt. It was as if he'd vanished into thin air, and to this day, neither he nor any clues as to his location have been found. When it comes to theories surrounding Eric's disappearance, an obvious possibility is that he suffered from some sort of hunting accident or medical event, and that searchers simply overlooked him. Presumably, this would mean that human, canine, and airborne searchers failed to locate him on those first 40 acres they searched, and also that no one has stumbled upon him in the 9 years since, which is difficult, but not quite impossible to imagine. Keep in mind that Eric was dressed in camouflage, which would have made him difficult to see in the woods, even if people were actively looking for him.
And depending on how long it had been before the FLIR passed over, his body could have matched that of the ground temperature.
Exactly. That infrared imaging would only have been useful if he or his body were warm. And if he had died somehow in the woods, his body would have cooled to the temperature of his surroundings rapidly. The temperature that night was only in the 20s Fahrenheit. I'm not sure how quickly the FLIR technology was deployed, but it's possible that if Eric died in the woods, it was too late by the time it was out there.
Yeah, it's a great technology, but it has its limitations, as most do.
It's very time sensitive.
And especially a decade ago when it was still relatively new.
Yeah. So as far as canine scent tracking goes, I don't know whether Eric was in the habit of doing so, but many hunters take extensive steps to conceal their scent when in the woods. They treat their hunting clothing with scent control detergent, carefully use scent controlling shampoo, soap, and deodorant, and even spray odor suppressing spray on the soles of their boots. I know we do all of those things when we hunt, Scott, and while researching this episode, I wondered, how effective are these measures against dogs, especially trained scent tracking canines?
Has anyone tested that?
Well, I looked into it and I learned that white-tailed deer actually have more scent receptors in their noses than dogs do. Their sense of smell is even more heightened than the average canine, if you can believe it.
So we need to train tracking deer?
Yeah, that was one of my thoughts. But, you know, good luck with that. They're pretty flighty, so I don't know how well that would work. But I thought, if an odor-suppressing spray can work on deer, it should work on dogs too, right?
Yeah, I would think so, depending on what scent receptors it actually blocks.
Well, as I learned from my research, it may not work so well against canines. I did a little looking it up, and the consensus seems to be that these products aren't very effective against tracking canines. I didn't exactly find any scientifically controlled studies, but I did find an article from Field & Stream magazine in which some curious hunters set out to answer this question for themselves. And in their experiments, scent control clothing spray did almost nothing to put a trained tracking canine off the trail. I will say that per their own admission in that article, the hunter didn't spray the bottom of his boots, and I also don't know whether he carefully applied scent control products to his body. For all I know, he could have been hiding from the dog with a head full of honey melon, wildflower, shampoo, conditioner, and styling spray or something.
Oh, come on, Field & Stream. Get it together.
Like I said, this is not some scientific peer-reviewed study. It's just what I could find. It seems that science doesn't care about studying this, which, all right. Overall, though, I doubt the ability of these products to conceal a person from determined tracking canines. Part of me wonders, though, whether thorough use of such products, if Eric even used them at all, it might have made the canines work a little more difficult. For the record, another part of me wonders whether these sprays even work on deer, and whether perhaps we've been spraying a liquid placebo all over our clothing. That, too, is a possibility.
I mean, if they did brilliant on them.
Either way, I find it very surprising that none of the search and rescue canines were able to track Eric's scent into the woods. And by the way, searchers didn't just use regular scent tracking dogs either. They also used explosives detection canines.
For the gunpowder residue?
Exactly. So law enforcement used explosive detection canines because they knew Eric had gone into the woods with a muzzle-loading rifle. And with muzzle-loaders, unlike typical firearms, you can't just pop a cartridge in and shoot. You actually have to load the gun basically with the separate components of a cartridge, a primer, powder, and the actual metal bullet. It's all separate. And handling those items would mean that Eric should have had enough gunpowder on his person for the explosive canines to detect. As with muzzle loaders, you can't wait until it's time to shoot to load a shot. It takes too long and involves too much noise and movement. It's normal to be walking around with a shot already loaded. And it's the powder that canines would be able to detect, so essentially, most muzzle loader hunters would have that on their person from the beginning of their hunt. And yet, explosive detection canines found nothing.
So the only caveat I have for that would be if he used like pellets like we use, and he used a pipe cleaner to load the pellets in, and he never actually handled them. And he kept them in a watertight container. That way, of course, they don't get ruined.
Yeah, I guess I just assumed that the gunpowder particles would be airborne at that point, that they'd probably be detectable to a highly trained canine. I mean, for example, when someone fires a gun, if you are in the room or anywhere near it, you're going to have gunpowder residue all over yourself. And
the key there is exactly what you said. When someone fires, had he not fired, they might not have had anything to go off of.
That may be true. I guess I know a lot less about gunpowder residue just from loading a firearm than I do from it actually being fired. And presumably in this situation, Eric's gun was not fired. So interesting. But overall, it raises the question, did Eric actually go into the woods at all? Is it possible that instead of going into the woods to hunt, he'd gotten into a vehicle with someone for some reason? That could potentially explain the lack of scent trail into the woods, and we'll come back to this idea later. For now, if Eric did go into the woods, there are many things that could potentially go wrong. Obviously, accidental firearm discharges are a danger, but so are many other things. Accidentally cutting oneself on a sharp hunting knife, falling from a tree stand, or tripping into a ravine. Eric was actually blind in one eye, so he might have been more prone to tripping or falling over an unseen obstacle than the average hunter.
So, with that said, this is like his passion. He is always doing that.
He is a very experienced hunter, above average.
So, there's two parts to this in my mind. One of them is that he's got this experience. He knows how to handle himself in the woods. He's been overcoming this for so long that it's just second nature to it. But the other problem is the problem that comes with expertise in any field, which is complacency.
I mean, yeah, so. Sometimes when it comes to things that could go wrong, even having a heart attack is a possibility. It's not unheard of for hunters who aren't athletically conditioned to overexert themselves while dragging and lifting a deer and suffering a cardiac event as a result. As best I can tell from photos, though, Eric seemed to be in good shape, certainly not overweight, but he was a smoker, which can take a toll on one's cardiac health. The thing is, though, as we've just discussed, if something like this happened, an accident or a medical event, the odds of Eric not being found by searchers seem low.
I would imagine if it did happen like that, if it was a cardiac event or mm-hmm. something along those lines, especially if he was trying to drag a deer out, there would have been a lot more scent to go on. And he also would have been, or it would have at least be likely for him to be within his normal area.
Right.
Of course, it's always true that a deer could run off and you would have to track it for a ways, which could take you off the beaten path. But it sounds like they combed that area pretty well.
That's true. But keep in mind, he was not hunting with a bow. And when we talk about deer running off and having to track them, we're usually talking about bow hunting. He was hunting with a 50 caliber muzzle loading rifle. So if he shot a deer, most likely the deer was not really going anywhere. Now, there is another possibility, though. What if another hunter shot Eric, presumably accidentally, and hid his body in order to avoid taking responsibility for their deadly mistake? So, in such a scenario, if Eric's remains were successfully hidden by his killer, they could be anywhere, which is a really frustrating thought. Of course, not all possibilities regarding Eric's disappearance involve accidental death. The fact that Eric's remains haven't been found despite extensive search efforts raises the possibility of foul play. According to investigators, though, nobody they interviewed had anything negative to say about Eric. He was considered a dedicated family man who was responsible, conscientious, and fair with his subordinates at work, so there's no obvious person who might have wanted to harm him. Nevertheless, I can't help but think about how those canines weren't able to track Eric's scent into the woods. What if he got into a vehicle with someone? If he did, presumably he didn't intend to go anywhere with them of his own free will. If he had, he would have taken his wallet, phone, and cigarettes. Could he have been abducted by someone? Someone who presumably took his life? If so, the person responsible could potentially have driven up to Eric's house either around the time he was departing into the woods or around the time he emerged from the woods. Or if Eric had been out of the woods and back home for a while, they could have literally come to his front door. Who knows? And they could have potentially have abducted, wounded, or killed him on the spot and then driven away with him in their vehicle. When it comes to this theory, though, the question is, why might anyone want to harm Eric?
My other question on that before we get into the why is, were there any signs of vehicle prints that didn't match?
Not that I know of. I haven't read or seen anything about that.
I would presume that there would be some kind of tracks. It doesn't sound like they live on like...
Despite Eric's good reputation, I couldn't help but wonder whether someone he worked with might have harbored a grudge toward him for some reason. What that reason might be, I can only speculate. Jealousy, perhaps, over Eric rising to a senior position at a relatively young age? Or perhaps anger over something that had gone wrong in the mines? Mines are notoriously dangerous places to work, and even with someone as conscientious as Eric supervising operations, accidents sometimes happen. Eric knew this better than most because he'd actually been in a mining accident himself. That was why he was blind in one eye.
Answered that question.
Yeah, so his partial blindness served as a constant reminder of the importance of safety equipment and precaution. He was always stressing the importance of protective equipment, especially eye protection. In the course of my research for this case, I discovered that in 2012, the year prior to Eric's disappearance, a mining accident had taken the life of a worker under his supervision. The miner had been working on repairing a water valve, which had been previously damaged and had become faulty as a result. Because of this, a tremendous amount of water pressure built up and sent a metal component flying into his face with deadly force. If you're interested in the technical details of this accident, we've linked to the investigative report on our website. But suffice it to say that it was a tragic accident that, according to the investigative report, could have been prevented. According to that report, the accident occurred because the mining company hadn't had effective policies, procedures, and training in place to protect miners when they performed work relating to the waterline installations in Track College. While the problem was much larger than any single employee, and Eric wasn't immediately present for the deadly accident, it was his job to ensure that the mine was in compliance with all state and federal safety laws. So, I wonder, could someone have blamed him for the deadly accident? Maybe a coworker or someone else in the community. Could they have lashed out at him over a year later in an act of perceived revenge?
I mean, people have reacted over much smaller things, for sure.
Now, this theory may be a bit of a long shot, but like I said, with Eric being so well-liked, there's no obvious villain in this story, so I tried to consider all possibilities. Another point of interest I discovered while researching this case is that according to public record, Eric purchased his home in 2012, so just the year before his disappearance. Since the property was newly his, this makes me wonder, could someone have been used to hunting, perhaps illegally, on the land surrounding his home before he purchased it?
I mean, it's certainly something that's come up and we've discussed before. I mean, having access to private land, especially in Virginia and especially during hunting season, is a tremendous asset. And if suddenly you lose access to where you've been hunting for so long and skirting government rules, it could definitely be motive. I can see that.
Yeah, in many states in the U.S., states where hunting is big, including Virginia, this is an annoyingly common problem. In fact, my own family has experienced some related issues. There are a lot of frankly terrible hunters out there who will trespass onto land they don't own or have any business being on and poach the wildlife there. And if that land changes ownership and the new owner starts actively managing it, the poachers may become angry because they feel an unjustified sense of entitlement to the land and the wildlife that live on it.
And another caveat to that is, say you weren't poaching, say you did have an agreement with the previous landowner. Those agreements don't transfer when the land transfers. You have to get the permission from the new landowner.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not privy to whether anything like this was going on the land that Eric owned, but I do think it's worth considering. Because if Eric stumbled across anyone poaching on his land, it doesn't exactly strain the imagination to think that an ensuing conflict might have caused the poacher to lash out violently, perhaps even shooting and killing Eric. Although I don't know of any information to suggest that's what happened, this theory certainly beats another theory I stumbled across online while researching this case. Scott?
Is this the crazy conspiracy theory time?
Yes, you're our unlikely conspiracy theory expert, so can you guess who, or perhaps what, some internet citizens believe may be responsible for Eric's disappearance?
So, obviously, somebody getting passed over for a promotion comes to mind, but that's too in line with other theories we've discussed.
Mm-hmm.
The obvious first suspect for a conspiracy is local law enforcement.
Oh.
But the way you said what?
Yes, that's the key.
That is the key. The conspiracy theorist in me really wants to say aliens right now.
That would be an educated guess, given the conspiracy theories we've discussed in the past, but I'm afraid it's not that reasonable.
It's not that reasonable?
No.
Oh my gosh. Okay, let me keep going.
Wait. Okay, let me just... There's no easy way to say it. I found a webpage suggesting that Sasquatch might have whisked Eric away.
That was where I was heading once you said aliens wasn't.
Oh,
I mean,
was it?
Well, okay, that was the guess after my next guess. My actual big hopeful guess was Mothman.
Now, this is close to West Virginia, so who knows?
So but that's what I was like, is this another Mothman sighting? Is this being attributed to Mothman?
Okay, Mothman would never. Mothman was clearly a lonely, abandoned, and misunderstood creature who just wanted companionship.
I'm sorry for tarnishing the name of Mothman.
Yeah, well, you should be.
That was my next guess. And then after that was far more likely Sasquatch approach.
I also would argue that Bigfoot would never. I like to think of Bigfoot as a mystical and peaceful denizen of the forest. Anyway, now, Scott, as you know, I'm one of the biggest Bigfoot fans out there. I've got the t-shirt, the stuffed animal, a novelty Sasquatch road crossing sign, the works. But I never let my status as a mega fan of the world's most mysterious hominid bleed into my professional life. And I won't either. At least, not unless my agency puts me in the basement one day and hands me a folder of X-Files. If that happens, all bets are off. But other than that, Bigfoot never comes into play when we're talking crime theories. So, moving on, my perceived vengeance theory seems pretty plausible in comparison now, doesn't it?
Well, until we have unprecedented proof that Bigfoot is non-aggressive, because he does have bad rep in some areas, not this one, but some, can we rule him out as a suspect?
I think we can, for a variety of reasons. And I won't go into those because I think that would be an insult to our listeners' intelligence. However, another theory, which was mentioned early in the investigation by police, is that Eric may have disappeared of his own accord. However, this theory seems unlikely, especially as time marches on. Not only was Eric dedicated to his family and job, but even if he had wanted to disappear, how would he have done so? His vehicle, wallet, phone, keys, and everything else he owned were all still at the house. There's no evidence to suggest that he disappeared voluntarily. Although no trace of Eric has been found since his disappearance, which was 9 years ago at the time of this recording, law enforcement has continued to investigate tips. For example, in April of 2016, a tip led investigators to search a long-abandoned mine that was located in Tazewell County, although certainly not on or adjacent to Eric's property where he'd gone missing from. It was some distance away. The search, which lasted 10 hours, didn't result in any discoveries. Clearly, though, the implication that Eric's remains may be in the mine is consistent with theories that involve foul play. Several years later, we're still left wondering, where is Eric? Did he suffer some sort of accident or medical event, and were his remains somehow overlooked? Or was his disappearance the result of foul play? So Eric's family, friends, and community are still waiting for answers to these questions. Eric even has a granddaughter who's never had the opportunity to meet him. If you know anything about the disappearance of Eric Smith, please call the Virginia State Police at 276-889-7660. And if you're someone who hunts in Tazewell County, please be on the lookout for any of the following things: human skeletal remains, weathered clothing or clothing pieces, particularly with a camouflage pattern, a titanium Timex watch, and a .50 caliber muzzle-loading rifle. If you find any of these things abandoned with signs of weathering or aging, they may be related to Eric's disappearance. Should you find anything like this, please contact local law enforcement immediately.
That's all for this episode of Last Seen Alive. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Make sure to check our website, lastseenalivepodcast.com, for photos from this story and links to the sources we use to write it. While you're at it, follow us on Insta and Twitter at LSA Podcast. New episodes of Last Seen Alive go live every other Monday. See you then. If you don't want to wait until then to hear more episodes, check out our Patreon, where we have full-length bonus episodes available for subscribers only. Also, if you enjoyed what you heard here today, please take a moment to rate and review Last Seen Alive and tell your friends to check us out too. We really would appreciate it. And finally, one last special shout out again for Alicia for throwing this before us. Last Seen Alive is written and researched by you, Leah. Audio engineering and editing is provided by me, Scott, along with our podcast production partner, Podcast Post Production.